This is part two of a two-part interview that I'm doing with Robin Wright. Robin Wright has reported from more than 130 countries on six continents. She is one of the most knowledgeable people about the Middle East and much of the world, but the Middle East is that area that fascinates me so much at this point, wanting to get what she knows out to as many people as possible. I remember an incident around the beginning of the war in Iraq in which I just happened – I don't usually watch the morning chat shows, actually, but I happened to tune in to Meet the Press just as it was beginning, and Tim Russert was wise enough to give Robin Wright an entire hour. And by the end of it, I just – you know, if I were going from that to church that Sunday morning, I would have been wishing that someone was listening – to Robin Wright, someone in the White House. She had written before that about reform within Islam and the, you know, earliest whiffs of political reform in the Middle East countries. And her new book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, is the current, you know, the current sort of state of where we stand on those issues. As she puts it, this is a book about disparate experiments with empowerment in the world's most troubled region. Her goal was to probe deep inside the societies of the Middle East for the emerging ideas and players that are changing the political environment in ways that will unfold for decades to come. Robin Wright, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Okay. So in the first interview, the first part of this two-parter, we talked about some of the big questions, and then we focused really a lot on Palestine, the situation between Palestine and Israel and so on. This time, I want to, for those who missed the first one, sort of ask you, why did you write this book, and did anything surprise you in the writing of it, in the culmination of it?
I've been traveling through the Middle East since 1973, and I felt that in the aftermath of Iraq, one of our great failings was we didn't know what was happening inside Iraq, and that was true of the whole region. So I decided to take a year off from the Washington Post and travel again through the 22 countries of the Muslim Middle East as well as Israel to get a sense of where the region is headed, who are the players, the ideas, what's the direction they're headed. And I think the thing that surprised me the most was that I found a new generation of activists who are doing things very different than what their parents were doing, carving out political space that didn't exist before, taking on autocratic governments, often at great personal risk. And I tried to answer the question, where's the next Lech Walesa? Where's the next Nelson Mandela? And I found the Nelson Mandela in, of all places, Syria, a man named Riyad Turk, and he's one of my favorite stories. This is a man who's been imprisoned over and over and over for defying and challenging the rule of the Assad family, now dating back decades. And the third time he was arrested, he was 50. He was held in a room the size of an elevator, no window, no furniture, no toilet, no bed, no contact with the outside world. He was never tried, never officially charged, never knew how long he was going to be held. No paper, no pencil, no books, no radio, no contact. And he kept his sanity by taking the uncooked kernels of rice from his soup at night. And during the day, he would use those pieces of rice to build geometric designs on the floor. And he was held that way for 18 years. And what's so shocking about it is that when he came out at the age of 68, having missed the childhood of his daughters, rather than to retreat into retirement and obscurity and safety, he tackled the government again. And what happened? He went back to jail again. And he's not the only one. There are thousands of people across the region who have called over the last few years for major change and have been imprisoned for their activities, including a man who came in second in a presidential contest against Hosni Mubarak. And what happened? He was imprisoned. So there are Nelson Mandelas out there, not just one.
Right. And I guess Nelson Mandela was in that prison cell, I think, for 27 years. So 20 years in, this is all one would have to say about South Africa, 25 years in even, and yet change did come. I know since we have the luxury in a way of doing the two interviews, I would like to let you, rather than me, you know, take you around the Middle East and ask you about each country, let you sort of tell me about the people. Because as you mentioned just then in that answer, a lot of your a lot of the book, it sets the historical context. It answers the questions, you know, what are the political situations and so on. But it really focuses on stories of, as you say, these individuals. And so let me open it to you. I'll respond. But some of the stories that you know, most excite you.
Well, what I did in the book is I took, after going to all countries in the region, I selected seven to focus on because I thought they were all countries that were models of the crisis of change, that there was a new dynamic. There were new players who were redefining the political landscape. And in a place like Egypt, for example, I found a young blogger in a country where the state controls all the media, print, media, radio, television. And the blogs have begun to carve out, again, new political space. And he put on his blog, all kinds of reports of protest movements, information that was not in the public press to educate people about what else was going on. And he managed to get a cell phone video of policemen beating up a detainee, including sodomizing him with the end of a broomstick. And he put that on his blog, and it ended up on YouTube. And it created such a public outcry that the government was forced to prosecute the two Egyptian policemen. This was a way of holding the government to account, publicizing human rights abuses in ways they hadn't been able to before. There are now over 1,000 bloggers in Egypt, and this is a third world country. And his blog alone, formed just 3 years ago, now gets between 30 and 45,000 hits every single day. And so this has created alternative media. There's another case in Egypt, again, a critical country because it accounts for over a third of the Arab world population. It's the political trendsetter for, you know, the peace process with Israel, the political, dominant political ideologies.
Let me ask you something about that, because you just piqued my interest. In other words, I would think that if you even asked people to name Middle East countries, some of them would forget Egypt. We mm-hmm. don't hear about it much. We hear about Saudi Arabia. We hear about Iraq, Iran, Palestine, Israel, Lebanon maybe. And yet over there, it's the trendsetter? Do people look to Egypt?
Oh, absolutely. And the interesting thing is that one of my favorite sayings about the region is that books are written in Egypt, printed in Lebanon, and read in Iraq. You have a highly literate population in Iraq, but it's the ideas that have traditionally come from Egypt, one of the few countries that has been an entity for millennia, unlike so many of the other countries in the region whose borders were created less than a century ago by European powers. But in Egypt, I met a woman named Gada Shabendur, and Gada had never voted, never participated in politics. And she was in the middle of a divorce, had four active teenagers, all athletes. She was a soccer mom in our parlance. And she happened to see on one of these new satellite television stations beamed in, again, beyond government control, pictures of women protesters who were being beaten up under the watchful eye of police by a group of thugs. And some of the women were even mauled. And she became so angry that she went out and joined the protest. And then she mobilized friends to form something called We're Watching You, which is the U is the Egyptian government, trying to signal we're going to monitor your activities. And they formed a group that, because international monitors are banned during elections, she and her group set up standards to get the word out. What do you look for during election in terms of violations and fraud? They started a website. They pass word around by word of mouth. During the presidential election, they got two cell phones wondering if they'd even reached one person. By the end of the day, they had over 1,000 detailed cases of election fraud. They did the parliamentary elections came after that. They hired a cameraman. And the trick in Egypt to get voters out is the government buses in its supporters to vote early in the day. And then dispatches police or thugs or others to hassle voters, particularly in opposition areas. And so they went to an opposition area and watched as voters, sure enough, were blocked from getting in to the schoolhouse to vote, who then took a ladder to climb over the fence to get in. And the police opened fire first with tear gas and then rubber bullets. So now GATA, this is a process that's played out in 2.5 years, is invited to help monitor elections in other Arab countries. So there are people out there who are doing things that are so different than we've ever seen in the region.
Right, that we don't hear about this at all. I know that as I'm listening, and I want you to point out a few more of these people, but as I'm listening, I know as I read the book, it begins to be so depressing to heartbreaking that each one goes, and then he went back to jail. And then, you know, the next election, the same thing happened. And then he was are any of these people making it through?
They're opening the door. They're nudging the door ajar. It's a beginning. That's all it is. This is something that's going to play out for the rest of my life. And I've been doing this for 35 years. But I think some are making a difference. For example, one of my favorite stories involves Iran.
I hope we could go to Iran next.
Iran has a very strange political system in that you have at the top of the political system someone called a supreme leader, and he can veto legislation. He can rule that certain candidates can't run for office. He can overturn political decisions by the president. He can reverse judicial decrees, and he is effectively the commander-in-chief. So he controls the military. The big debate in Iran is, should the supreme leader be subject to the Constitution, or is he above the law? Does he have the kind of infallible powers of a pope, a political pope? And
because, for anyone who doesn't know, he is a religious leader.
That's right. He is a grand ayatollah. Right. And one of my favorite characters is a man named Hadi Khamenei. And Hadi has stormed the country, arguing there should be a supreme leader who's elected just like everybody else and should be part of the Constitution. And he started a newspaper using his editorials and news space to write about this critical issue. He's given lectures throughout the country on this subject. He's often beaten up, occasionally hospitalized for his after being injured, to make the case that he even tried to run for office and was disqualified, even though he's a cleric as well. He was told he was not Islamic enough, but trying to make the case that the rule of law had to be imposed in Iran and the supreme leader couldn't have absolute power. What makes him so interesting is that his older brother is Iran's supreme leader. So again, you have diversity not only in a society, but within a family.
Wow.
There's no longer one path. You know, Islam literally means submission, as in submission to the will of God. And it's often in the eyes of the fundamentalists been those who strictly believe in one path, no deviation. And the idea that there is such diversity emerging is one of the most hopeful signs in the region.
And you introduce us to the term Ijtihad, which I interviewed Irshad Manji, and of course her whole book really talks about that. And for people who don't know what that is, tell.
Well, it's the process of interpretation. And the great challenge in the Islamic world today is to try to blend the ideas of Islam and democracy. We in the West went through the Reformation within Christianity, which gave birth to the Age of Enlightenment, and then modern democracy, a period that has lasted 400 years, and I say as a woman, is still not complete. What we're trying to see happen in the Islamic world is both things happen, political transformation and a reformation within the faith to open up, to say there's more than one path. That's asking a lot. But again, there are a lot of people now who are engaging in new ideas. Another character is someone named Sarush, and he's the Martin Luther of Islam. And he's popularized—
Also in Iran, right?
Also in Iran, that's right. And he has popularized an idea that says, to be a true believer, you may have come to your faith from your family, your community, your country. But for you to be a true believer, you have to have embraced that belief by your own free will. And therefore, freedom precedes religion. That's a revolutionary idea, and it's taking the first big step in the process of an Islamic reformation.
It's funny, when I came across that quote in this, I remembered it from your earlier book that I had read prior to our interview in 03. How much has that notion, because it seems, like you say, I mean, to us, it might, okay, but it's such a radical notion that you cannot really say you've chosen God if you didn't do it out of freedom. And so that really, as you say, steps it, okay, so we're free first, then we choose surrender, submission, that sort of thing. How much has his idea caught on?
Oh, he's very popular, and he has a huge following in Iran. In fact, the clerics have given him a very hard time, and he's ended up teaching part of every year in places like Harvard, Princeton, Yale. He's now this semester at Georgetown University in Washington because the clerics go after him so often. He's often also beat up by the kind of religious vigilantes. But his ideas, you know, it plays out in a lot of different ways. It's not just philosophers. For example, there was a movie made in Iran by a man who had been into revolutionary propaganda in the early years, also had a falling out with the system. And he made a movie about a married woman who had an affair with a younger man. And the end of the movie has three endings, as told by from the point of view of the married woman, her husband, and her lover. The movie was banned not because it told a story of adultery, but because it had three diverse endings and that there was not one absolute truth. So this change takes place in a lot of different ways that we don't fully anticipate.
It's funny. There was a book I read, maybe now it's going on 30 years ago, which is, I'm going to forget that, Walter Truett Anderson. And basically his premise was that the confrontation, and I'm saying this was about 85, I think, the confrontation that we're really facing now is between those who hold one truth and those who hold many truths. That in the past, before all the communication and so on, it would be my truth against your truth. But what's much more threatening to the one truth people is that there could be more than one truth.
And that plays out not just in the Middle East, that plays out in our own country. In many ways, we talk about the clash of civilizations, and it doesn't happen, I don't think, between the Islamic world and the West. It often happens within all of our societies. Opening up is what it's all about. That is what the 21st century is going to be all about.
I often have said that I do believe there's a clash of civilizations going on, but mine isn't represented. If you were speaking to someone who said, okay, so there's a few people of enlightenment, they're, you know, and they're constantly imprisoned, beaten, tortured, killed, etc., the real clash, getting back to the clash of civilizations, that even if there are numbers of people who feel that way, the real clash that we face right now is the West against something they might term Islamofascism. What do you say to that? And by that I mean, is there a real danger? How real is that assessment? Even if they're a small minority, are they enough of a danger, etc.?
Oh, I think they're a real danger. I stood in front of the U.S. Embassy in 1983 after it became the first target of a Muslim suicide driver anywhere in the world. And I lost friends at the embassy and a subsequent embassy in Lebanon that was bombed, as well as at the Marine compound, where we had the largest loss of U.S. military life in a single incident since World War II. Yes, they're a real danger. But I think what we have to understand is that these are a minority, and that theirs is an agenda that attacks us because we're seen as a prop for autocratic regimes.
Right. Let me just emphasize what I think you're saying there is that though the turn against us, the turn against the U.S. as the Great Satan or even the West was second. First, it was against their own autocratic governments that they felt were not sufficiently Islamic?
Well, thought they had been that they betrayed their people. In the case of Osama bin Laden, it was his anger, fury at his own government, the kingdom, which he felt had become corrupted, was no longer true to Islamic values. And that's what resonated initially among many Muslims disillusioned with autocratic regimes. That's why he had appeal. The reality is, now that we're 7 years after 9/11, that these groups, and they have proliferated, They are more dangerous today than they were on the eve of, or the day after 9/11. They're in virtually every Middle East country, small cells of them. But the reality is that the majority of Muslims have begun to reject them. And we saw in Jordan, for example, after the triple hotel bombing by an al-Qaeda operative that ran the cell in Iraq, 100,000 people turned out on the streets shouting, "Burn in hell," about al-Qaeda, that these were not rent-a-crowds like you'd often see in some Middle East countries where the government orders them to come out.
I often do this when people, I think, if you miss that, 100,000 people in
Jordan, which has a small population.
Right. Marched on the streets against the actions of al-Qaeda.
Yes. So there are those who understand that there...
You also mentioned a statement of 2,000 clerics.
Absolutely. 2,000 clerics calling on the United Nations to pass a new resolution or treaty that banned the use of religion in warfare and calling for a tribunal to try what they call the sheikhs of death. But we had just this week the president of Senegal, who is hosting the Islamic Conference Organization, a group of 57 nations that span from Morocco to Indonesia, saying we must end the era of jihad and war, and that we don't want to be in any kind of clash of civilizations, and we don't want Muslims to be identified with hatred and death.
So some people will say that the moderates among the Muslims don't stand up enough. You're saying they are doing it. They do it. We don't hear about it.
It's the beginning. I mean, because we've been so afflicted and so shaped by the trauma of 9/11, we basically want every single Muslim to sign a petition and vow never to engage in anything, including criticism of the United States. That's never going to happen. But what we're beginning to see are strong, important voices saying this is not what represents most Muslims. All the public opinion polls taken, not just in the Middle East, but in the broader Islamic world, even though they may totally oppose U.S. policy, do not want to destroy America. That there is an enormous differentiation between American political leaders and American people. Most of them want to find some form of coexistence. And their primary focus is, again, not us, but it's their own life.
Yeah. Let me ask you, since you just mentioned political life here as well, if you were, with your knowledge and experience, advising a presidential candidate right now, what would you advise them about Iraq?
Oh, about Iraq, that's a tough one. There are no easy answers. The tragedy of Iraq is that we steamrollered in. We didn't understand what we were getting into. We didn't prepare for it. My fear is that the American patience has run out. We're tired of reading about death and failure, more suicide bombings, inadequate electricity, all the things that have gone into the failure of our reconstruction.
And I would say one thing that finally seems to be dawning on people is how much it's costing us in money at a time when suddenly the economy is not doing so well.
$12 billion a month.
Yeah.
The cost to our treasury long term, not just today, is putting us in terrible debt, and our military is broken. So all of us would like to see American troops pulled out tomorrow. But the reality is there's a danger that if we steamroller out of Iraq quickly, that we leave behind an unstable environment in which we have to go back at some point, as we did in Afghanistan, because there's not stability. So the solution is clearly not another 100 years in Iraq. The region won't tolerate it. We can't afford to do it. The American military doesn't have the forces to do that. The question is, how do we do it in a way that we don't leave behind a bigger mess than the one we went into to solve? You know, that the problems aren't greater than the one we went into to solve. And that's not easy. There are no easy answers.
So if, again, let's say I'm asking you for advice and, you know, it's what is, and I won't hold you to it, you know, a year from now, but right at this moment, what is the smart, prudent, pragmatic way to deal with it? And I'm asking you because partially I don't think I have any sense of, you know, what the threads are on the ground there.
Clearly, we have to do more in training the Iraqi military faster and better. We also have to show that we intend to get out and pull some troops out as a show of good faith. We also have to make sure that if we have any kind of military agreement, which is now being discussed, something called a State of Forces Agreement, SOFA, that we don't doesn't look like we're trying to establish permanent military bases in Iraq. That if we withdraw to bases, it is only to back up the Iraqi forces and that it's designed to be very temporary. Permanent military bases in Iraq is not a viable option. We also need to get the neighbors more involved, including dealing with Iran and the kind of dialogue we have between the ambassadors in Baghdad, between the Americans and the Iranians. But we need to get the regional group we formed with the six neighboring countries much more involved in offering the kind of guarantees. We need to nudge Saudi Arabia, which still refuses to accept to host the prime minister of Iraq because of the Sunni-Shiite divide, even though the president of the United States asked the king of Saudi Arabia to allow a visit by an Iraqi neighbor. He has refused because he doesn't believe that the government is strong enough or can follow through on the guarantees it's making. But we have to understand that this is that our long-term presence in Iraq is going to cost us. But we also have to exit in a way that doesn't leave Iraq in greater turmoil.
Okay. Thank you. The book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. The website is robinwright.net. Thank you, Robin Wright. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terry.